Welcome Anthony Rondi. He's our pastoral resident intern. Cool bald guy. All
thanks,
of the
buddy.
Above. Bringing us the Book of Ruth this morning. So.
Man, that verse, "His glory shine in vessels weak," really hit me as I have been blessed to preach on Ruth this morning, and I'm wholly unqualified to present such an incredible book to you. So we find ourselves in our series, Route 66. We're going through the Bible in 1 year. And I'm blessed to be able to speak on the Book of Ruth. But the Book of Ruth happens in the time of the Judges. And remember from last week, the time of the Judges was an incredibly bad time to be in Israel. God's people are constantly disobeying him, needing to be saved by judges that he raises up. But things just get worse and worse as time goes on. There is this downward spiral in Israel. Yet, if anybody is acting righteously or justly, it is the women. We see that in Aksa boldly asking her father, Caleb, for springs to go with the land that he had given her and her husband. We see this in Deborah accompanying Barak into battle, in Jael consummating that victory by luring this general into her tent, offering him shelter, lulling him to sleep with milk, and driving a tent peg through his skull. I think we even see this in Jephthah's daughter, where we have this horrible vow that Jephthah has taken to kill the first thing that comes out of his tent. And it turns out to be his beloved daughter, Jephthah, but she knows that this vow was taken to God, and it can't be taken back. So she goes to her death with this nobility and righteousness. But one of the tragedies of the judges is that while we see these righteous women acting, their male counterparts constantly fail them. Othniel shrinks back when Aksa prompts him to ask Caleb for the water. Barak is too afraid to go into battle without Deborah, and Jephthah makes the vow that costs his daughter's life. I think that is in large part the reason that we find ourselves in the situation that we do in the book of Judges. And as we begin the book of Ruth, we start in much of the same way. We find in the very beginning that there is a famine in the land, and so this family from Bethlehem moves to Moab, which is an interesting choice because Moab is a country that is, they've attacked Israel twice, in fact, first during the Exodus and another time earlier in the book of Judges when Ehud had to act and cast them out. What's more, the Israelites looked on the Moabites with a certain amount of disdain due to their origin with Lot's incestuous relationship with his daughters. So this is an interesting choice, but I think it says something about the state of Israel that this family has to move there. And this family is comprised of Naomi, her husband Elimelech, and their two sons. Eventually, the two sons take Moabite wives. But pretty soon, tragedy strikes, and Naomi is widowed. She is left without a husband. Eventually, her two sons die as well. And with no husband and no sons in the ancient world, Naomi is in an incredibly vulnerable and dangerous position. Widows were seen largely as just a drain on a society's resources. They couldn't really speak for themselves, and they couldn't protect themselves. So they occupied a very low position in the social order of the ancient world. Because of this, and because Naomi hears that things are better in Israel, she attempts to return to Bethlehem. And her two daughters-in-law try to come with her. But she tells them to go back to their mother's house because at least there they'll experience some level of protection, and it's very likely they can eventually get remarried in Moab. But if they come with her, there's not really a future there. And she sends them away with this interesting blessing in verse 8. She says, "Go each of you to her mother's house. May the Lord deal in loving kindness with you as you have dealt with the dead and with me. The Lord grant that you may find rest, each of you in the house of her husband." So Naomi introduces here this concept of chesed. It is translated loving kindness or love or kindness. but it can't really be captured by any of those words alone, because it is all of the varied ways in which God demonstrates his covenant loyalty. So it's mercy, kindness, love, loyalty, goodness, and loving kindness. And it is used most often of God. It is rarely used of human actors. And it is with this kind of blessing that Naomi attempts to send her daughters-in-law away to kind of save her from the future that awaits her in Israel. So Orpah leaves. Ruth, however, refuses to leave Naomi, and she takes this kind of vow. She says, "Do not urge me to leave you or to return from following you. For where you go, I will go, and where you lodge, I will lodge. And there your people shall be my people, and your God my God. Where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. May the Lord do so to me and more also, if anything but death parts me from you." And as I was researching the book of Ruth and considering it, I was asking myself the question, what does Ruth know about God? This is a formal vow of conversion. Ruth is declaring, "I am now a Yahwist. I am no longer going to follow the gods of the Moabites." But what exactly does that reveal about what she knows? This isn't she doesn't recite a catechism and list everything that she believes or knows about God. This could just be a formality, because if you're going into a foreign land, you're probably going to take their gods. But I actually think it says an incredible amount about what Ruth knows of Yahweh, because in this vow, which will drive all of her future actions, Ruth is displaying hesed toward Naomi, which is characteristic of God. So Ruth is revealing that she understands a great deal about the nature of God. However, in Israel, Ruth will be in an incredibly vulnerable state. Not only is she a widow, she is a foreigner as well. She is kind of doubly low. And we are not at a happy ending right now. Just because Ruth is accompanying Naomi, both of them are still grieving the loss of husbands and sons and brothers and fathers. And they know that they are going into an uncertain and dangerous situation. And Naomi expresses this. When they return to Bethlehem, the women of the town are asking, "Is this Naomi?" And she responds, "Do not call me Naomi," which means pleasant. "Call me Mara," which means bitter, "for the Almighty has dealt very bitterly with me. I went away full, and the Lord has brought me back empty. Why call me Naomi when the Lord has testified against me and the Almighty has brought calamity upon me?" So Ruth and Naomi are just in this incredible state of grief, facing an uncertain and dangerous future. We begin chapter 1 by Ruth, driven by her vow to take care of Naomi, declares her intention to go glean from among the fields. This process of gleaning was a provision in the Levitical law that allowed people to harvest the very edge of the field. Landowners were prohibited from harvesting the whole field. They had to leave the edge so that poor and destitute people could come and find some way to survive. This wasn't a thriving, but a mere survival. You'd likely get enough grain to last you for a day. And furthermore, this is incredibly dangerous for Ruth, because again, as a foreign widow, she is at the very bottom of the social order. And we know we're in a time in Israel when people aren't exactly being obedient to God's law. So she faces the threat of both physical and sexual assault as she enters these fields. But she is doing so compelled by her vow to Naomi. Also in the beginning of chapter 2, we are introduced to Boaz. And Boaz is called a mighty man of worth. So there's these two terms used here. First, Gibor, he is a mighty man. He is a mighty warrior. That's the same word used of David's mighty men at the end of 2 Samuel. So Boaz is not a guy you want to mess with. He is also called a man of worth, a chayil. This is a term that kind of has connotations of nobility and honor. Boaz occupies the top of the social order in Israel. He's comparable to like a medieval knight who is a wealthy landowner, a trained warrior, and has many servants under him. We also find out something about Boaz in his greeting to his servants. He says, may Yahweh be with you. And they respond, may Yahweh bless you also. And by introducing Yahweh to the conversation, Boaz is kind of hinting that God is at work in this scene, even though it's not explicitly stated. Boaz then notices Ruth, and he asks his foreman, whose young woman is this? And this is not a romantic interest on the part of Boaz here. Ruth is a widow. She is dressed as a widow. She is visibly unavailable for marriage. Rather, Boaz, a landowner, seeing a stranger in his field, asks who she is. And the foreman responds that this is Ruth, the Moabite, who came back from Moab with Naomi. And she has been working hard. She's been working her butt off to get enough grain for her and Naomi. We also find that Ruth has made a bold request of Boaz. Ruth asks if she can gather from among the sheaves after the reapers, which is against the rules. That's not what the laws of gleaning said. The laws of gleaning said you can harvest at the edge of the field. They said nothing about following after the reapers and gleaning from among the sheaves, because these are sheaves. Imagine how much more grain you would get if you got to pick from that as opposed to having to harvest the grain all by yourself. So is this a misunderstanding of the law on the part of Ruth? She is a foreigner. It's possible she just heard about this custom of gleaning and she is assuming certain things about it. It's definitely not necessarily greedy, but she's asking a lot. She's asking to take way more grain than she would usually get. I think this is not a misinterpretation, but rather, as in chapter 1, we're finding out exactly what Ruth knows about this God. Because the letter of the law said, let them glean from the edge of the field. The spirit of the law said, feed them, take care of the poor and oppressed among you. And Ruth is understanding this deeper interpretation of the law, and she's presenting it to Boaz and saying, will you be obedient to God's nature? And this is a bold ask, because not only is she asking for more grain, she's kind of challenging Boaz. She's challenging his pride. He just considers himself, if he considers himself a righteous man, imagine his reaction to a foreign widow telling him what the law means. But Boaz's response is not of pride. He responds saying, now listen, my daughter, do not go glean in another field or leave this one, but keep close to my young women. Keep your eyes on the field that is being reaped and follow behind them. I have ordered the young men not to bother you. If you get thirsty, go to the vessels and drink from what the young men have drawn. So not only does he grant her request to follow after the reapers and glean among the sheaves, he offers her water, which is a precious resource in the ancient world. And you got to wonder, Ruth is gleaning from morning until midday at this point. It's not as if landowners are necessarily commanded to give everybody access to their precious water sources. So what is Ruth drinking? Does she have this water in this nasty animal skin that's been sitting out in the sun all day? So by giving her access to water, that's an incredible blessing. But Boaz extends his protection to her as well. He's saying, essentially, and this is a message to the community. If you mess with Ruth, you mess with Boaz. And as we said before, Boaz is not a man you want to mess with. And Ruth understandably asks, why on earth are you doing this for me? Why have I found favor in your eyes? And Boaz responds by saying, all that you have done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband has been fully told me, and how you left your father and mother and your native land and came to a people that you did not know before. May the Lord reward you for your deeds, and may you have a full reward from the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge. So Boaz has heard about the hesed of Ruth, and he responds to that hesed with his own act of hesed to her. And there's more going on here than a simple blessing of protection and water and grain, which is significant. And Ruth picks up on that in verse 13. She says, may I continue to find favor in your sight, my Lord, for you have comforted me and spoken kindly to your servant, even though I am not one of your servant. This servant language, it's not as if she's just saying, you are a lord of the land and I am at your service and in your servant in that way. This is an official position. Boaz is elevating Ruth's standing in the community. She was at the very bottom of the social order. She's moved up. And the community is going to be aware of this. And again, they are going to respect Boaz's judgment on this. She is essentially now one of his employees. So Ruth continues to glean until evening. She comes home and with 48 pounds of grain. Naomi, understandably surprised, asks, "Where on earth have you been?" And she tells her it's in the fields of Boaz. And Naomi points out that this was also an act of chesed on the part of Boaz, but she goes further to state that Boaz is one of their redeemers. Now, this redeemer language, the role of a redeemer was a social provision by which God's covenant promises could continue to be realized even for families in crisis. So the redeemer provided the means by which jeopardized covenant blessings, namely land and lineage, could be regained and thus served as an appropriate metaphor for God's grace. So two key functions of a redeemer. First, they could buy back land that had been sold out of poverty, and therefore they're keeping the land in the family. Because remember, God had given not only this land to the nation of Israel, he had apportioned certain parts of land for each family. And if that family loses that land, there's a sense in which the covenant is in jeopardy. So they could buy back land. They could also marry the widow of a dead relative, have a child with her, and the firstborn son of that union would inherit the land of the dead relative, not in the name of the redeemer, but in the name of the dead relative, and in that way continue that family line. And Naomi keys, when she says he's one of our redeemers, she's hinting at a couple things. First of all, she's aware that she has redeemers, and she's kind of like, yeah, we should kind of be getting redeemed here. But she's also pointing out that in Boaz's actions, he has done a slight amount of redeeming. He has elevated them a little bit. And we'll find later that Boaz isn't the closest redeemer, so it's not quite his place to fully redeem them. But despite that, Boaz is aware of their situation and uses his high social position to elevate them a little bit. Moving on to chapter 3, we find this strange plan of Naomi's. Naomi, her mother-in-law, said to her, "My daughter, I need to seek some security for you so that it may be well with you. Now here is our kinsman Boaz, with whose young women you have been working. See, he is winnowing barley tonight at the threshing floor. Now wash and anoint yourself and put on your best clothes and go down to the threshing floor, but do not make yourself known to the man until he has finished eating and drinking. When he lies down, observe the place where he lies, then go and uncover his feet and lie down, and he will tell you what to do." So what this is not, it is not a racy love scene intended to entrap or seduce Boaz. First of all, there's very little in the Hebrew that suggests that, and what there is... There's a word that may be a euphemism, but that's not even the word that's used. It's a different form of that word. So there's nothing in the Hebrew to support that. There is simply a little bit of ambiguity by this uncovering and feet. But if you try to read this racy love scene into this, you have to jump through hurdle after hurdle after hurdle, which makes it very apparent that's not what's going on here. Furthermore, what do we know about Ruth and Boaz? So far, they have acted with an incredible amount of righteousness and obedience, and they both displayed a great deal of understanding of the nature of God. They're not about to break his commandment now to ensure Ruth and Naomi's future. So what is going on? Well, Naomi, again, a widow, no social standing, she's got to find a way to secure Ruth's future. And one of the ways she can do so, the primary way, is through marriage. But marriage in the ancient world was instigated by a male, had to be done by a male relative. So Naomi creatively comes up with a way to propose marriage to Boaz without the help of a male relative. She chooses the perfect time. Boaz is going to be celebrating the end of the harvest, and by sending Ruth to him in the dark, it will not impugn either of them if the plan fails. Furthermore, by telling Ruth to put on to wash, anoint herself with perfume, and put on a different garment. Ruth is sending nonverbal signals to Boaz that marriage is in view. Remember, she was dressed as a widow until this point. She was visibly unavailable. Now she is presenting herself as a woman who is available for marriage. By uncovering his feet, she's letting the cold air do the work of waking him up. And by prostrating herself at the feet, she is putting herself in the position of a petitioner. And this is something Boaz is going to catch on to. So she went down to the threshing floor and did just as her mother-in-law had instructed her. When Boaz had eaten and drunk and he was in a contented mood, he went to lie down at the end of the heap of grain. Then she came stealthily and uncovered his feet and lay down. At midnight, the man was startled and turned over, and there, lying at his feet, was a woman. He said, "Who are you?" And she answered, "I am Ruth, your servant. Spread your cloak over your servant, for you are a redeemer." So Ruth does what Naomi asks. She deviates a little bit, kind of showing the boldness and the cleverness of Ruth. When he asks who she is, she responds, "Ruth, your servant." And she uses the same language of spread your cloak. Cloak can also kind of mean wing. She uses the same language that Boaz used in chapter 2 when he said, "May you find refuge in the wings of the Lord." So she's essentially saying, "Hey, remember when you said, may God repay you for what you have done?" You could kind of be that repayment. And also by using redeemer language, she's making it obvious that her request is that Boaz redeem her. And Boaz responds wonderfully. Not only does he accept her request and point out that this is another act of hesed, because Boaz is older. You know, he's no spring chicken. And old in this time, you know, that can mean 40. But he points out, like, you didn't go after the young men for marriage. You went after the older men because you knew that in doing so, you could redeem yourself and Naomi and lift her out of her dire straits as well. What's more, Boaz further elevates the status of Ruth. He said, "May you be blessed by the Lord, my daughter. This last instance of your loyalty is better than the first. You have not gone after young men, whether poor or rich. And now, my daughter, do not be afraid. I will do for you all that you ask, for all the assembly of my people know that you are a worthy woman." This worthy woman, he is using that same term, chayil, that was used of him at the beginning of chapter 2. So he is essentially saying, you are now at the same social standing as me. And remember, she was at the bottom, and he has elevated her all the way to the top. However, he points out there is a closer redeemer, but he tells her, "I am going to go into Bethlehem tomorrow morning and force his hand." She then sends Ruth home with grain, which is a sign of his intention to not only Ruth, but Naomi. And we're also seeing Naomi slowly be filled back up. Remember, when she came back to Bethlehem, she was empty. She's slowly getting filled back up by the hesed of Ruth and Boaz. Chapter 4. We have a meeting at the gates. Gates were the principal public places of the town, as well as the site where courts of justice were held. And it says something about Boaz, that this wealthy landowner would drop everything at the end of the harvest, when he's probably preparing his land for the coming winter, and go into town to settle this matter right now instead of at a time that it would have been more easy for him. Also says something about Boaz that as he waits at the gate for this closer redeemer, who is unnamed, mind you, to shame him, because by refusing to redeem Ruth and Naomi, he was leaving them without a name. He is then left without a name for all of history. But when Boaz sees this redeemer, he says, "Hey, you, sit." And it says something about the status of Boaz, that when Boaz says, "Hey, you, sit," you sit. Boaz then goes and gathers 10 elders, and he says, "Hey, you, sit." And when Boaz goes and grabs 10 elders and tells them to sit, apparently they just sit. Boaz then proceeds to break all of the rules. Boaz says, "Naomi, who has come back from the country of Moab, is selling the parcel of land that belonged to our kinsman Elimelech." That's not how the ancient system of inheritance worked at all. Widows could not inherit the land of their dead husbands. If they were able to, this situation would be a lot easier to be resolved because Naomi would have a bunch of land at her disposal. But apparently, when Boaz says that Naomi can inherit the land of her husband, Naomi can inherit the land of her husband. And in doing so, he is forcing this nearer redeemer to either purchase the land or relinquish his rights as redeemer and allow Boaz to purchase the land. Furthermore, he is forcing this redeemer to buy land that he would have inherited anyways. But again, apparently if Boaz says, now you have to buy this land, you have to buy this land. And the closer redeemer, when only presented with the prospect of land, he decides, yes, I will redeem it. Land was incredibly valuable in the ancient world. It was kind of the equivalent of wealth. However, when this foreign widow, Ruth the Moabite, is introduced as well, he abdicates. He says, no, I don't want it because it will kind of contaminate my family. So the Redeemer is seeing Ruth in a certain light. He is seeing her according to her status as a foreign widow, and he doesn't want her to contaminate his family. Boaz, meanwhile, immediately turns around, assumes the responsibility of a Redeemer, and redeems Ruth and Naomi in the sight of all gathered. We conclude the narrative with this wonderful picture of Naomi, who came back to Bethlehem empty in an incredible amount of grief at having felt abandoned by God. And she is now pictured sitting with this male child, this male descendant in her hands, and she is completely filled and her fortune completely reversed. There's also genealogy included. And this genealogy gives us a hint that not only has Naomi's fortune been reversed, but the reversal of Israel's fortune has begun. Because we're pointing forward to David, the king, who would finally complete the conquest, unify God's people, and lead them in following God. So for Israel, coming out of this dark time of the judges in the book of Ruth, Ruth is kind of hinting at what's coming. It's like, hey, Dave is coming. And we get a hint of the reversal of our fortune as well, because Ruth and Boaz show up in another genealogy much later on in the Gospel of Matthew. And it is the genealogy of Jesus Christ, who would come to lift us up out of our dire straits as well. Also think it says something about the fact that Ruth is included in Matthew's genealogy along with three other women as a reminder that God uses unexpected people to complete his purposes. Here, an incredible woman, a foreign widow who by her acts of hesed saved the line of David and of Jesus from extinction. Mind you, like, they were this close to being extinct had she not acted, and Boaz not acted, and Naomi not acted the way they did. So let us spend some time considering the hesed of our Redeemer, Jesus Christ. First of all, it is galvanizing. Just as Ruth left her family, her homeland, and her culture, everything she ever knew out of hesed for Naomi, so Christ moved actually a much greater distance. Though he was in the form of God, did not count equality with God a thing to be grasped, but emptied himself, taking the form of a slave and being born in the likeness of men. Jesus Christ, second person of the Trinity, Son of God, remaining what he was, became what he was not and took on humanity. God eternal stepped into history. This monumental movement. Hesed is also submissive. Just as Boaz submitted to Ruth's deeper interpretation of the law and her righteous request for redemption, so Christ too submitted to the will of the Father. And one of the best examples of this is in the Garden of Gethsemane, the night he was to be betrayed and imprisoned hours before his torture and death. he says to his disciples, "My soul is consumed with death, sorrow to the point of death. Stay here and keep watch with me." And going a little further, he fell face down and prayed, "My Father, if it is possible, let this cup pass from me. Yet not as I will, but as you will." He submitted himself to the will of the Father. The chesed of Christ is also sacrificial. In the same way that Ruth sacrificed her future and jeopardized her life for Naomi, so too Christ sacrificed his own life for us. He himself bore our sins in his body on the tree that we might die to sin and live to righteousness. It's by his wounds you have been healed. Finally, his chesed is redemptive. Just as Boaz used his high station in society to lift Ruth and Naomi out of their poverty and grief, so too Christ used his high station to lift us out of our slavery to sin. In him we have redemption through his blood, the forgiveness of our sins according to the riches of his grace. So real quick, how do we apply this? First and foremost, we have to realize that we too are in need of redemption. We stand with Ruth and Naomi at the very bottom of the social order, and we have absolutely no right to boldly approach God and ask for anything except through the redemptive act of Jesus Christ on the cross. Second, we need to let go of our ego and submit to God's will. Both when confronted with deeper interpretations of the law that offend our pride and when our culture is offended by God's commands. We have to let go of our ego, let go of what people think of us, and submit to God's will and commands. Third, we need to allow ourselves to be led by chesed into dangerous or uncomfortable situations. Chesed should get us out of our comfort zone. Ruth moved to Moab. Jesus became fully man, and we need to think about where God may be leading us and who he may be leading us to show chesed to. Fourth, be willing to sacrifice our time, money, energy, or even our lives to show chesed to our neighbor. I think we see in this that chesed is active. It is not passive. We need to engage our imaginations in creativity and spend time thinking of people who need chesed and ways in which we can show it to them. Finally, chesed is redemptive. Just as Boaz used his high station to lift people up, and so did Christ, we too occupy very high stations in our society. We live very privileged lives, and most of us are very materially wealthy, and our culture tells us that we need to cling to that as tightly as possible. But the clear example of Boaz in Christ is that we need to use that to lift others up.